little bit of a cooler day today. Cloud cover and maybe rain, actually, for at least the east side of the province. I know we've talked about this, but if you go on the Environment Canada app, or if you just go on their website, check out the radar. It's crazy how the system literally moves from south to north in the province, but it totally ignores that west side of the province, which so desperately needs the moisture. I said this morning, I often, when I see rain is coming, I'll immediately go to Swift Current, Maple Creek, just to see, are they getting it? Because, gosh, they need it down there. But it looks like maybe by Monday, but for the long weekend, parts of this province will get some rain, so it might change your long weekend plans. Well, we have talked about the opioid crisis on this show in a few different ways. I mean, inevitably, when we open up phone lines, people want to call in and talk about some of the challenges that are happening in their community. The drug crisis, the challenges with mental health and addictions and how those two things combine, it's always a big talk topic. We have leaders in like mayors and police chiefs. We talk about it with them. We've actually had a couple of recent guests on the show. We had Alberta's provincial government minister of mental health and addictions, Dan Williams. Remember, that was just about a week and a half ago. We had Dan on the show. They have put forward a Compassionate Intervention Act. And if passed, it's actually in the process right now of being passed, but if passed, it will see adults and children mandated into treatment if they're deemed a risk to themselves or others. They've got a fairly strict process of how that can happen, and there are independent people that sit on this panel. It's got to meet certain thresholds. There's lots of checks and balances. And again, it wouldn't be for everybody, but it would be for those that are at a high risk to themselves or others. And there are lots of those people out there. Then we brought in Sarah Kazusko. Sarah is a great community leader. She's a pharmacist. She operates Queen City Pharmacy in Regina. Sarah talked about some of the methods that we have available to try and help people through this addiction problem, and maybe what some of the counter arguments would be to something like secure treatment. And I've said many times on this program, I am a person that believes secure treatment facilities have their place in our communities. But there are lots of people that are on the front lines of this. So while you and I talk about it, and while decision makers and politicians decide what to do, there are people that are rolling up their sleeves, putting on their gloves, and every day dealing with this crisis on the street. And my next guest is one of those people. Saskatoon Police Service Sergeant Chris Harris is a 19-year veteran of the police force. He knows all too well the harsh realities of this opioid crisis because he is out there walking the streets, doing this work day in and day out. And I'm so appreciative that Sergeant Chris Harris has joined me in studio today. Sergeant, thanks for being here.
Very happy to be here.
19 years, first of all. I remember when you started it. It goes by quick, doesn't it?
In a blink of an eye. Yeah. It seems the first 10 years were a blur.
Yeah.
And then the last nine have just flown by as well.
So describe for us where you work. What is your job with the Saskatoon Police Service?
So I'm a sergeant with the bike unit. We're primarily downtown.
Okay.
Basically from 25th Street to the river, to Idlewild Drive. Right. We dip a little bit into the Riversdale bid. But primarily downtown.
Okay, so you're the bike unit, which is like the outdoor beat or the downtown beat, essentially. I mean, there's lots of different ways to look at it, but you're out there in the community. What do you do in the winter, by the way?
We're in patrol vehicles.
Okay.
We're riding
But
around.
You're still in that same area.
Yeah, so, always downtown.
So that area has you dealing with this overdose crisis. Can you give me some thoughts through your career, which is the better part of two decades, how you've seen this change?
It has, the difference is night and day. From when I started, I think they were at the tail end of kind of the crystal meth epidemic that was going on at that point. And we had done a really good job as a police service and as a province to kind of squash that a little bit. And it's subsided for a little while. But in the last 5 to 7 years, it has just made a resurgence that I don't think anybody was prepared for. Mm-hmm. And contributing with other factors, it's just kind of become this perfect storm where it's all anybody really talks about and deals with on a day-to-day basis.
Crystal meth is not gone.
No.
It's still out there, but crystal meth causes a different sort of a reaction and a problem in the people that are using it than fentanyl does. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Crystal meth, basically, especially when it's mixed with fentanyl, it gives a very prolonged high. Mm-hmm. It causes irregular behavior patterns. It causes hallucinations. It causes basically a detachment from reality. Mm-hmm. Users are known to be up for days on end, have very finite focus where they focus on one thing. Like I've watched people under the influence where they are cleaning, but they're not really accomplishing anything. They'll pick up a piece of paper and they'll look at it and then they'll set it down and then they'll kind of go back and pick up that exact same piece of paper and then move it back to their left. And they just do that for hours mm-hmm. and hours at a time, really accomplishing nothing, right. but their brain is just in overdrive and they right. just can't shut it down.
The overdose crisis, which, I mean, we have had, the drug problem has been here for a while, but what we're seeing now and what we're dubbing as the overdose crisis is really a direct result of the types of drugs that they're doing. Fentanyl, other derivatives of that are causing overdoses, and it's happening. Well, tell me how often it's happening.
Multi-daily.
Yeah.
There's multiple calls just at the start of shift yesterday morning, right outside City Hall. There's an individual that's in distress that we just came upon. It was nobody had seen him. A lot of these times we're just stumbling upon these people. I've, in the last 2 weeks, I was riding around at 2 o'clock in the morning and on 4th Avenue, I see somebody that's kind of leaning up against a building. It looks like they could be sleeping, but it's not a spot where somebody would sleep even if they were unhoused. Mm. And so you're like, well, I better check on them to make sure they're at least okay. And they weren't. And so Narcan is administered. Right. And
so I want to talk a bit about this, Chris, how this works. Sergeant Chris Harris is my guest with the Saskatoon Police Service. So how do you know if the person is by themselves, how do you know they're overdosing? What are the signs you look for? And walk me through what you actually do.
Sure. The signs are kind of, they're conscious, they're breathing. Lots of times it appears almost as they're in a deep sleep. Mm-hmm. They're snoring, they're basically looking for air. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get air. They're not very compliant to pain stimulus and just kind of a weak pulse, but it's there.
So I'm going to stop you there because sure. when you say that, not everybody will know what you mean by pain stimulus. Right. So you're trying to wake them up, but you're doing like that sternum rub, for yep. example. If a person is just simply sleeping, not yeah. overdosed, they'll wake up from that.
They'll definitely wake up because even if they're sleeping, it's not comfortable. So they're going to know that something's happening to right. them and they're going to at least make some sort of motion to either go to where that pain is, mm-hmm. even if they're feeling it subconsciously, and they're just going to try to stop it. Mm-hmm. And so that way, at least you know that they're sleeping. But yeah. if you're getting nothing, then you have to take the next step and realize that there's something more than just somebody being like extremely intoxicated right. or just sleeping.
Right. Okay, so you do the sternum rub. You're trying to wake them up. They're not waking up. Is there more that you do to try and determine, could this be an overdose, or is there a downside to administering Narcan if they basically haven't overdosed?
There is no downside to administering it. Yeah. Essentially, if I feel that they're not simply intoxicated, I will take the next step. So I'll already automatically get Medivy on the way to assist them medically. And then from there, I'll just continue to assess. I will see, and there's lots of times where they still have paraphernalia with them. Mm-hmm. They might have a pipe in one hand and a lighter in the other. That's how fast these overdoses can occur. Wow. They, before the high has even hit them, they're already in the throes of an overdose. So mm-hmm. if they've got paraphernalia around them, it could be a syringe, it could be a pipe, it could be a lighter. Mm-hmm. If they have those things, obviously I'm going to put two and two together and realize chances are they've consumed something within the last little while sure. that's accelerated this overdose.
Right.
So then from there,
And the Narcan that you carry, is it the nasal spray?
Yeah, okay. It's just a 4 milligram naloxone nasal spray.
And how quick does it work?
So I would say about 5 minutes. We usually try to wait 4 to 6 minutes in between dosage. If you double up very quickly, it's not any more effective. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to wait for that first dosage to take effect. So essentially you're administering it just like a Dristan nasal spray, like right. you did back in the day. I don't sure. know if people still use yeah. Dristan nasal spray. But just like you used to, you squirt it in, yeah. You sit them up and just kind of massage the nasal cavity, kind of get it going, get it absorbing,
yeah.
and you're waiting for ambulance and waiting for any signs that it's kicking in.
I have a couple of follow-up questions from this, but I guess the first one is, when they come to, is it a handshake, thank you for saving my life? Is it an understanding that you saved their life? Or, I mean, I know and have seen, it can also be aggression.
Right.
Right. So what does that look like?
I would say very rarely is it a thank you for saving my life,
yeah,
unfortunately. Lots of times it's a denial. Lots of times it's like, I wasn't. I didn't overdose. I didn't do anything. I'm not sure if they're worried that they're going to get in trouble, or it's the embarrassment that they had to be revived, or right, it's a contributing of all of those mm-hmm factors. But it's usually like, I didn't do anything. And unfortunately, 9 times out of 10, they're even refusing medical service. Mm-hmm. They don't want to interrupt their day. I think they just essentially lose a block of time,
right,
and they're revived, they're okay. But what people that are revived don't understand is that naloxone's only a temporary fix. Mm-hmm. The effects can wear off. So if you've taken a significant amount of opioids, it can reactivate mm-hmm in a short amount of time. So if you're refusing medical treatment, we push and push and push, but at the end of the day, you can't force yeah somebody to get medical care.
Sergeant Chris Harris is my guest. I mean, that's why what you just described is why we see multiple overdoses from the same person in a day. It could be continued drug use or just the amount of drugs they used. Once the naloxone effect wears off, they're back to where they were. And we can't have, whether it's you or other, I mean, we've got so many incredible community organizations in our province that are doing frontline work, like our emergency services personnel, but we can't be there 24/7. And that's no the challenge. So here's the problem is we still have lots to talk about. I want to take a break. You're good to stick around for a little
absolutely
bit. Okay. We're going to take a break. I want to talk about, first of all, what's the wear and tear like on our emergency responders? What is this like every day riding this roller coaster? It's taking you away from other things that you would be doing. And where do we need to go? How do we get to where we need to go? There's lots of partners involved, but I am curious to hear a frontline responder's view on what some possible outcome changers might be. So we'll continue this conversation with SPS member Sergeant Chris Harris when we come back here on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. Thanks so much for joining us. We are chatting with Sergeant Chris Harris of the Saskatoon Police Service, and I wanted to have Chris come into studio and talk about what he is seeing. He's a frontline officer. He works in the area in Saskatoon, or a couple of areas in Saskatoon, where we see the drug problems, I would say, more prevalent than we do in others. And we just had a good conversation around essentially what it looks like to respond as a first responder to someone who is in crisis, who is overdosing. You talked about how they're often in denial. Sometimes they can be confrontational when they come out of that overdose state. How do you deal with that? And by you, I don't just mean you, Chris, but other first responders, could be paramedics, could be firefighters. I mean, this is an everyday, multiple time a day occurrence. How do you, number one, deal with the roller coaster that this provides? And even from a standpoint of compassion fatigue, how do you keep caring enough to go out there and do this stuff?
I mean, you keep caring enough because that's what you signed up to do.
Yeah.
Like, you signed to put on the uniform every day and help people. Either they're, and I've said it before, it's kind of a cliche, but everybody that we deal with is likely having the worst day they've ever had. And so you have to just realize that you have to leave that stuff at the door and you have to help people through mm-hmm whatever it is they're going through and do yeah what you have to do that. And having a life away from work is a huge component of that. Mm-hmm. Either extra time with your family or activities that you do away from work just to kind of leave it. You can't wear the badge 24 hours a day mm-hmm or you don't stand a chance in the long run, especially with the changing climate, right, how things are, and every day it's just kind of snowballing, mm-hmm, right? So you got to find the pleasures in other avenues in life and just kind of come here. Don't take it personally. It has nothing to do with you. You're just helping people, and that's how you have to look at it.
I noticed we've got a few texts coming in as you and I are chatting, and one of the texts asked, what should people do? I mean, most people going downtown, maybe to the Midtown Plaza, they're not carrying naloxone, but they might see someone who they feel is in crisis. Is that a 911 call, or what do you suggest people do?
I would say 100% it's a 911 call. Yeah. If you feel that somebody is in distress, even if it's not, it's still worth checking on them and making sure that they're okay. I mean, I stop people that I see sleeping in the morning it's very easy just to walk by them and think, ah, oh, they're fine. But it takes 2 seconds to go over and be like, everything okay? Mm-hmm. Are you all right? Yeah, I'm fine. Good enough.
A lot of people aren't comfortable engaging in that way. And you're not recommending to touch the person, but just to do a bit of a visual check, I guess. But here's the thing. And I ask this with some knowledge about what you do. Before this overdose crisis, or let's say today it stops, you're still going to be busy. So what happens to all the work that you could be doing? Some would argue you should be doing when you're out responding to overdose after overdose after overdose.
Unfortunately, it sits and it waits, or it just doesn't get the response time that it might deserve.
Right.
It's kind of, you have to triage as best you can. Right.
But you know, this is a case where I think it's safe to say we're talking from the vantage point of police, but more cops is not the answer. I mean, more cops is helpful, but more cops isn't dealing with the problem, right?
No.
I mean, it would be like adding more firefighters, more paramedics. Yeah, okay, you're spreading the workload out a little bit, but you've still got people overdosing at an alarming rate.
Yeah, it's been said numerous times, like, we can't police this problem away.
Right.
You can't jail it away. Like, that's not the answer.
So I want to get to some potential solutions in a second, but I also want to clear up a bit of a misconception, because it happens often. We talk on this program about overdoses. We talk about mental health. We talk about addictions. We talk homelessness. We talk about bear macing and bear spraying happening on city buses, which happens in this city, Saskatoon, quite a bit. How related are all of those things? And is it safe to say some people are lumping people into categories that maybe is not necessarily factual?
I would say with fairly good confidence that they're not related at all. I do not feel that it's the unhoused population that is responsible for the bear spray incidents that happen on a regular basis.
Is there a connection between homelessness and crime in general?
I wouldn't, not, no, I don't think that there is. I think that the feel that the homelessness and the unhoused portion is more of a social disorder type of thing. They're not committing crimes. They're not to the point where it's like a widespread epidemic where it's, you can just point the finger at them and say, it's all the unhoused people that are doing this. It's not.
Now, crime might be part of the drug use, right? That could be where the crime comes in. And in some cases, how do you get the drugs? You might be committing a crime in order to afford to be able to buy the drugs or acquire the drugs. So needless to say, we're up against the clock. We're not done talking. Can I keep you here for a little
bit? Absolutely.
Am I going to get Cam McBride, Chief McBride, calling saying, hey, we need this guy back on the street?
I could be more mad at me than you.
Okay. Well, we'll keep Sergeant Chris Harris here for one more segment talking about overdoses, the response, and where I want to go next is what are we doing that's working? What are we missing? And where else should we go? That's the conversation we will wrap up with here on 980 CJME and 650 CKOM. Well, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Evan Bray here today with Sergeant Chris Harris. Chris is a sergeant with the Saskatoon Police Service and works in an area, including the downtown, where you see a lot of overdoses. And that's the notion of what we're talking about here. It's just another angle to look at the overdose crisis that's happening and the interplay that happens between a lot of these social problems. And Chris, this is what we were talking about going into the break. Now, I said, you know, I had a texter one day who said, I'm tired of these homeless people that are bear macing people on the buses. And I said, well, I can't say for sure because I'm not on the front line, but I'd be surprised if it's a strong line between the homeless community and the bear sprayers. I mean, those sound like the punks that think they're part of these youth gangs and those types of things. You're nodding your head.
You wouldn't be wrong.
Yeah. But you can't say that the homeless problem is free of crime, because I saw a text here from someone who lives in Fairhaven and says, you know what? I can tell you that there is a correlation maybe in terms of thefts, those types of things. So
absolutely. Yeah. They're not driving it, but it's a part of the lifestyle, but they're not driving crime.
The drug and mental health thing is, does one precipitate the other? Is it people with mental health challenges that are becoming drug addicted, or is it people with addiction problems and it's almost manifesting bigger mental health problems? How do those two play together, or should they even be lumped together?
They definitely, I think they're lumped together. And that's the $64,000 question is did this come first? Did this come first? Right. Does this exacerbate this?
Right.
Sometimes they're part and parcel, and sometimes they're two totally mm-hmm. separate issues. Not everybody who has an addiction has a mental health crisis. Not everybody who has a mental health crisis is drug addicted.
Well, and I think maybe that leads us to where I want to go, which is to get to the root of that, to figure that out. You really have to peel things back and try and treat some of those issues to understand which is driving which and what does stabilization look like. And I have said many times on this show, and I have a lot of people that will agree with me, and I have a lot of people that don't, and I respect the opinions on both sides around secure treatment. My point is, if I'm a person who is desperately searching to make a difference and solve the problem, what we're doing right now is not working. I'm looking at a guy who's spending his whole shift out there using Narcan, Naloxone to try and revive people when there's lots of other work that you could be doing. Obviously, that's important, but my gosh, that we should not be having all of our first responders doing this. For a certain segment of the population, I feel like secure treatment facilities would be beneficial. They stabilize people and they give you a chance to better assess what success could look like and give the person the chance through their own wellness journey and dignity to understand what that could look like. What do you have right now for a resource? If you come across someone who's overdosing and you think, I can't leave them here, we have to take them here to get them help, where can you take them?
Unfortunately, the buck kind of stops at the hospital, the healthcare providers.
Which is not the perfect place.
No.
I mean, that is a, you know, that's a passing of, you know, a person who's in risk and clearly probably a good place for them to be from a health perspective, but not a long-term fix.
No, and part of the problem that we run into as well is none of the shelters are available, because if you're taking somebody who has these complex needs, either mental health or drug addiction, the staff of these shelters and these treatment facilities still have to concern themselves with other people that are residents there and their own staff members. Mm-hmm. And they can't put them at risk by bringing somebody in who is either a danger to themselves or their staff. So then it's kind of, you're left in limbo.
Well, you saw that with the Saskatoon Tribal Council Wellness Center, right? Chief Mark Arcan said, okay, this group of people, you're not welcome here. The problem is, where are they going? Fairhaven will tell you where they've gone. They're in the community, right?
They're left to their own devices.
Right.
Which either means they fall deeper down the hole of addiction, or they find somewhere for the evening or the next day, and then they kind of start to cycle all over again.
Mm-hmm. I've talked with our Minister of Health. I've talked with our Premier on this show about the notion of secure treatment facility. If we had something like that, understanding there'd be capacity issues, but do you think that would make a difference, Chris?
So as me, you asking me as an officer, not as a representative of the Saskatoon Police Service, I agree 100%. Yeah. One, what we're doing right now isn't working, so let's try something different. And two, if you make it all-encompassing, where you have wraparound services, where you get one facility where you have mental health and addiction treatment, you have psychological needs that these people need, you have medical needs that these people desire, all under one roof, and you can transition them to other housing slowly, it's a staged process. I feel I don't understand what the harm is in trying these things. Mm-hmm. And without getting too deep down the rabbit hole, I know one of the bucks against it is that it's impeding people's civil liberties or it's involuntary. But you're also talking about people who have kind of lost the ability to make these decisions on their own. Mm-hmm. Conversations no different than placing somebody who's intoxicated in public under arrest and taking care of them and finding them a place, whether it's cells or a detox facility. They've lost the ability to make conscious decisions for themselves. So we are forced to intervene and make decisions on their behalf until they're stable enough to make those decisions for themselves.
And I agree with exactly what you're saying, Chris. And I think on top of that is give them some stability and a clear head to also focus on some of the other social challenges that they might be dealing with. But it's, I mean, to me, it's about instilling hope and giving them a foundation that is solid enough that they can make some positive choices. Now, Sarah Kosciusko, who's been on my show before, I talked about her. She operates Queen City Pharmacy, Wellness Pharmacy in Regina. One of her big concerns is if you go to a model where you've got secure treatment, like Alberta's looking at, if all you do is invest the 90 days or 4 months or whatever it is, and then turn them back out into the same environment, you're setting them up for failure. So there's clearly more to be thought of here.
100%. I don't know anybody that's suggesting it's simply a 90-day program. Right. I am talking about an all-encompassing. It could be a year. It could be 2 years. Whatever it takes to get somebody where they're stable enough that they are able to make a transition to either assisted living or living on their own. But that is a long way away for some of these folks that that we have to at least attack it, the problem at its root, before we even get to those stages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't help but think, and I know I've talked with some of the government officials about that, that there would be a cost-benefit analysis that could be drawn out. How much time? Take the wages of our first responders. Take the work that, we talked about the safe site in Saskatoon,
Prairie Harm Reduction,
who have been over capacity. I mean, if you think about the money that is spent to try and just keep people alive in the state they're in versus something that hopefully would be a path to wellness, there's got to be a cost benefit there.
Yeah, you have to look at it as a short-term pain for long-term gain. Sure, it might cost a lot up front, but the benefits that you're going to reap 2, 3, 5, 10 years down the road are going to be recouped by the money that you've saved from having to constantly deal with this segment of the population that has exploded.
I would also argue that this is not, police are not the best setup. You happen to be on the front line. You happen to be the one walking by to see them, as you said, in front of City Hall yesterday. But you're not the best setup to do this type of work.
No, I mean, without throwing myself under the bus, there's nothing exceptional about me that I'm more qualified than you to administer naloxone to somebody. I'm basically propping them up, squirting it into their nose and checking for vital signs. Right. Anybody can be taught to do that. So it's definitely wasn't in the brochure when I signed up for policing 20 years ago.
Yeah. If I were to, I'm kind of going back to what your day-to-day operational work looks like, but you're assigned, you do patrols in that downtown area. If you take the time where you're actually in duty, like on duty, but in the execution of your duty. So I'm not just talking the free time you have to do patrols, which is essential. How big of the percentage would the work with overdoses take of your day? Would it be 25%?
I would say probably 25% would be a fairly healthy estimation.
Which is, you know,
it's enough.
It's too much.
Yeah.
It's certainly, I can tell you, back in Evan Bray's day, working in downtown Regina, it wouldn't have been 5%. So hearing it, and I know we were just chatting about a young firefighter that you and I both know in Saskatoon here who, that's all they're doing is responding to these types of calls. So we need to find our way through this for sure. But the ability to have, I would say that the benefit of having seeing it through your eyes is beneficial. So we're really appreciative that you're willing to come in. Thanks for giving us a little bit of your time, Chris. This has been good.
Anytime, my pleasure. Yeah.
And I would be remiss if I didn't say thanks for what you're doing out there. It's not easy work. And there's a whole plethora of things that you do outside of just this overdose thing, but always appreciative of that. So thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
That is Sergeant Chris Harris with the Saskatoon Police Service, and the whole notion that we've talked about numerous times on how we are best set up to deal with this. I know we've heard from the Premier, we've heard from the Health Minister. They are looking at other options, including what you see going with the Compassionate Intervention Act in Alberta. Is that something that comes here? There's some hints that sort of legislation could be coming our way, but at this point, just talk. Nothing definitive has been put to paper, and as we know, the spring session is just wrapping up today, so they will be on their break. Perhaps by fall, we'll see something manifest in that area. You're listening to 980 CJME and 650 CKOM. for joining me, Evan Bray. Great to have you here. Thanks again to Sergeant Chris Harris with the Saskatoon Police Service. Great chat with Chris. I kept him longer than I planned to. But, you know, even as I was walking him out of the control room here and thanking him, you know, he said, I'll tell you right now, if I were to talk with the people that I interact with every day, these are the people that Chris just gave us an example of, people overdosing. He's using Narcan to bring them back to at least a healthy state where they're not going to die as a result of the overdose. He said, I firmly believe that if you ask them, would you rather be in some sort of a facility where you're going to get regular meals, you're going to have opportunities to talk to and work with people to better yourself, to better your life, it's going to be in a good environment, you'll be with other people that are also trying to better themselves, or would you rather be left out here to dumpster dive, to continue with this tragic lifestyle? He said the vast majority, he firmly believes, would say, yes, I will take option one. And those that aren't going to take option one, it's likely because of how heavily and deep they are into their addiction that they can't see that light. And I'm telling you, this is me saying this, not Chris, but you know, he agreed that there is something out there. And I know I'm seeing texts on the line saying, this stuff costs money, how are we going to pay for it? Totally agree. This is going to cost money. But if we don't do anything, how much is it costing you as a taxpayer to have the cops and the firefighters and the paramedics and everybody just continually respond to the same thing over and over? Okay, speaking of city issues, I just bumped into Lara Fominoff in the hallway and I thought, hey, you were at the Greater City of Saskatoon Chamber of Commerce State of the City address yesterday, Lara, and you and I didn't get a chance to chat about that yesterday because it concluded after my show was over. But yeah, Thanks for joining me in the studio here for a second. Of course, Evan. So how was that? So this was Mayor Cynthia Block's first opportunity for one of these State of the City addresses. What were some of the talking points that she brought up?
There were lots of talking points, but as Cynthia Mayor Block says, she remains, her quotes, steely focused mm-hmm. on trying to address the homelessness issue in Saskatoon. So that, you know, was something she once again talked about, was the homelessness issue. Her take is that, you know, once we are able to build more affordable housing and have lots of wraparound services in those buildings, several of which are either in the planning, pre-planning, or already in the construction phase, that will go a long way to help many of the people who don't have a place to go right now, who don't have access to services, and who don't have you know, a safe place to be. So that was a big part of it. The homelessness, she talked about a new direction for the business community as well. There was a little survey handed out. She wants to get feedback from the business community on what they would like to see happening in the city and how the city of Saskatoon can help out with their mandate and their focus.
Mm-hmm. How was that received? Just because I know this was a chamber event, right?
Right.
It's very business focused. I'm guessing it was business people that would have mm-hmm. been there. What was the reaction to some of the things that maybe would be possible steps forward?
Well, I think there was a little bit of a surprise initially that there was this sort of QR code survey at everyone's mm-hmm. Table place setting. Yeah. She said this is the first step in this, right? So we haven't figured out.
Input.
Yeah, we're gathering input, gathering intel on this, and then we're going to move forward with that. So a business forum.
And I wanted to check in because one of the stories that I know made it into our newscast mm-hmm. is she didn't shy away from the fact that the property tax hikes are likely not done.
Well, that was sort of, that was a two-part question from the Greater Saskatoon Chamber of Commerce CEO, Jason Abig, saying, hey, you know, budget deliberations are happening in late November, early December. It's going to be the first of a two-year cycle. So that's what Saskatoon operates on, a two-year budget cycle. And this will be year one of that. So where are you heading? Do you have any indication right now of where property taxes may fall? Mm-hmm. Because we had a fairly large one in the last budget cycle. Mm-hmm. So how's that going to look? And she said, well, I'm not gonna sugarcoat it too much. I don't have a number for you right now. We're also gathering that information. We work on it all year long, but it's probably not going to be a not small property tax hike. So
Okay, well, I appreciate you giving us an update on that. Obviously, we'll follow along, but maybe good food for thought for my next time that I have Mayor Block in the studio. We can follow up on that as well.
Absolutely.
Lara Fominoff from our newsroom, senior reporter, thank you very much for stopping in today.
Anytime.
You're listening to 980 CJME and 650 CKOM.